You're listening to The Political Scene, a show about current events and the political forces driving them. I'm Michael Luo, the editor of NewYorker.com, filling in for Tyler Foggett. This weekend, a man shot and killed 11 people at a ballroom dance studio in Monterey Park, California, an Asian enclave outside of Los Angeles. Then, less than 48 hours later, in Half Moon Bay, California, another man shot and killed 7 people, at least some of whom were of Chinese descent. Mass shootings take place with mind-boggling regularity in America. These two attacks also happen amid an alarming rise in hate crimes targeting people of Asian descent. I called my colleague J. Caspian Kang because I wanted to process these twin tragedies with him. Jay is one of the most insightful writers in the country on the politics of immigration and identity. He's the author of the book, The Loneliest Americans, which tells the story of Asian immigration to the United States since 1965. Hi, Jay.
Hey, how's it going?
So, Jay, let's start with Monterey Park. The news of the shooting there broke basically in the middle of the night. I woke up early on Sunday morning on the East Coast and saw one news alert about it on my phone. At first, all we knew was that it happened in Monterey Park, a community with the large Asian population, and that it took place after a big Lunar New Year celebration in the community. There's also obviously this backdrop of the surge in anti-Asian violence since the pandemic started. I think you texted me after you got up and heard the news. What did you think when you first heard about what happened?
Oh yeah, I think that there's like a process that one goes through. At least I did, and a lot of people that I spoke to in the past couple of days go through, which is first, if you know anything about Los Angeles or even Asian American communities, Monterey Park is like Flushing, basically, right? For the West Coast, I mean, it is a very large, predominantly Asian suburb. It's also where a lot of people all over Los Angeles, you can go to eat Chinese food or Asian food. And so, you know, it, aside from just having a population there, it's also sort of a cultural center. And so it would make total sense to have a Lunar New Year festival there, for example. And then once you sort of identify that in your head, then you sort of cross-reference it with the other thing that you're talking about. And then this sort of anxiety sets in where you're just like, oh no, what if this was like targeted? What if this was like, you know, I don't know, quote, like motivated by hate? And it's a very discomforting place to be, because at some level you think, yeah, that would be really bad, you know? But then the thought that also comes up is just like, well, there's like 11 people dead, you know? Like, does it make it worse? You know, or is it like somehow better if the shooter is Asian, you know? And like, what does that mean? And I think we're sort of trapped in that type of mentality now. It might be just a response from the trauma of the past 3 years, right? Or it could be something a little bit more nefarious, right? Where there's almost like a narcissism to it. But I'm still trying to like, you know, work myself through it. I don't know. Where are you with all of this right now?
Yeah, I mean, my first full-time job in journalism was at the LA Times, and I would go to Monterey Park regularly to go grocery shopping. But my other connection to the story is I actually have spent a lot of my journalism career writing about guns and gun violence and how gun violence really is a public health emergency. Thinking back, knowing what I know about gun homicides in America, probably the first reaction should have been, okay, this was likely a domestic dispute.
Right.
But I confess that was not my first reaction. I started thinking about history and the parallels of history. I happened to be working on a book about the history of Chinese immigration to America. And there's a whole chapter. I spent a lot of time thinking about this massacre that took place in 1871. It was 150 right. years ago in October. It just sort of came up as like this major event. LA is actually, the city of LA is taking steps to mark that event, maybe come up with a memorial. And, you know, I started to think about this sort of straight line.
Like, I think there's this interesting moment, right? Between when the sheriff says at the beginning, the suspect is a male, right? And then that's when everybody starts speculating. And then several hours later, he says, male Asian, right? And then like, it's almost like something has been deflated, right? And that, that like all the narratives that people are working up in their head, especially like, you know, people whose job it is to build these narratives, which is like me, you, you know, the people that we work with, that something like is kind of released, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have to reroute. And the question that I have is like, we all know that if the shooter, if this was motivated by hate, as you know, like as they say, I don't know what that means, honestly, but let's say it's motivated by hate, right? We all know what the narrative is, right? There's a scaffolding that we pick up almost and we place it over the event, right? And then there's all sorts of stuff that happens. Like, for example, there's history that is brought into it, right? There is personal narratives that are brought into it. There is like a whole lexicon of terms like perpetual foreigner or whatever, mm-hmm. all that is placed on it, right? And I think that all that is appropriate, right? And I think that that is, it's necessary and it's helpful for people to understand the thing. What is strange to me is that the other side, there's nothing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's like a diverging path here, right? If we take one path, we know exactly what is going to happen, exactly what's there, what is there to be said, so much so that you can pre-write these pieces, right? And on the other side, it's going to just be, well, what a tragedy, as you pointed out in your piece, right? Like another senseless tragedy, this another day in America, people say, share like the Onion headline, right? And that's about it. And like that sort of imbalance, I don't know. I don't mean to condemn anything, but it's certainly interesting to me right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's fatigue, right? There have been so many of these mass shootings and suddenly it becomes just another mass shooting. That sounds like that's terrible to say. And I've been thinking about examining sort of myself and my sort of journalist editor hat and thinking about what does that kind of mean, the fact that we as a society, we in the media have this fatigue on covering mass shootings. It takes actually at this point something unusual for a mass shooting to break through.
Right. You know, at this point, I think there's 11 people who have died from the shooting. Many of them are elderly. For me, at least the heartbreaking part about it, you know, among just the loss of life is that, you know, Lunar New Year dance studio, you know, this is, when you picture it in your mind's eye, you see these sort of elderly Chinese people dancing on like a night of celebration, you know? And, you know, I think that there is a way in which we sort of erase the identities of some of these victims and, you know, people have these sort of responses where, you know, you do photos and you tell a little bit about this, but I don't know, how are you processing that sort of, you know, that image?
I mean, yeah, it's human nature to relate to victims through your own sort of story, and they sound like my parents, you know, and we're also going to start to see stories of the victims in Half Moon Bay. And I do think that these are always tricky moments for media because, like, there is a sort of a fear of kind of descending upon, like, these communities and the sort of invasion of privacy. But, you know, one of the most beautiful things I think that the media can do is kind of remember the victims of these shootings and kind of tell their stories. You know, and I actually think about how important that is. As somebody who's looking back in history, one of the most frustrating things, for example, in the Chinese massacre in Los Angeles or other sort of these horrific attacks that happened to Chinese immigrants in the 19th century is the voices of the Chinese are so absent from the historical record. And so the ability to sort of tell those stories today, to have reporters who can bridge those sort of gaps of language and culture and tell those stories is really vital today and for the future. Going back to the context of both Monterey Park and now this Half Moon Bay shooting, which as we're sitting down to tape this podcast, we're only now learning details about it, but it sounds like it's a 67-year-old Chinese man who worked at one of the farms in the area. The shooting took place in two different locations in this rural area. And I also bring up another mass shooting. Last year, there was a shooting at a Taiwanese church in Orange County in Irvine, where the shooter was a 68-year-old Asian man, a security guard from Las Vegas, whose life was basically falling apart. What do you make of the fact that now we have this trio of mass shootings from older men who really don't fit the typology of mass shooters?
Well, I like resist, you know, categorically, generally drawing those types of lines when we have so many data points overall, right? Like, that's the tragedy of all of this. Like, if there were 5 mass shootings in the last 2 years in America, and 3 of them had been elderly Chinese men, then I'd be like, eh, that's a little bit interesting, you know? But, you know, this is a daily occurrence, and I don't think that it really says anything. I would be very resistant to read any type of narrative that came out on it. Now, I know that there are some out there already that have said that, well, this was because there was so much gun buying in the United States during the pandemic, and that Asian Americans particularly bought a lot of guns, right? But like, what we know about this guy in Monterey Park is that he had guns well before the pandemic, right? Like, that was reported in the LA Times this morning. So what does that mean? You know, like, does that fit that narrative then, right? I think that what we can say is that, you know, mass shootings have become so common that it is now a sort of all-inclusive thing. And that, like, just the novelty of this person being Asian American, like, I would just, I think, categorically reject any narrative that was built out of this, especially right now, until we find more information. Maybe there is information that would point to something like that, but right now it seems like we have nothing, right? And it's just all speculation. Because I will admit, yeah, it unsettles me, you know? Yeah. Like, I'm like, you know, yesterday, the way I found about it is I saw the video. They had sort of apprehended the guy and rolled him on the ground of a parking lot, and then I could see his face, and I was like, whoa, that's another Asian dude, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you feel unsettled. But I don't know. I think at that point, that's where it's like good to just be like, okay, yeah, well, you know, like, drawing some sort of narrative between the two is wrong.
Yeah. I mean, Asian American community is just like any other community in America with access to guns. This thing in Half Moon Bay sounds like a workplace type shooting. I'm not sure exactly what the motivation is. We don't know yet in the Monterey Park shooting, but it sounds like he frequented these barroom dance studios, and right, maybe there was a personal animosity that he had to somebody that was there. Maybe he was looking for somebody. And in that way, the Asian American community is just like any other community in this country. You know, I do think about the Asian experience in America. In many cases, it can be an isolating one, particularly for immigrants, particularly for the elderly community. There's language differences. That's why a lot of times you see a lot of elderly Asian immigrants who don't speak English who are in these enclaves in Chinatowns, like Flushing, you mentioned, Monterey Park is another, New York City's Chinatown. You know, remember, these Chinatowns really began as a protective mechanism. And you're doing the responsible thing, is to not speculate, and I think that's correct. I do think about what the experience must be like in the pandemic, amid the sort of backdrop of all this stuff going on for elderly Asian men. I don't know if you think that that's not responsible of me, Jay.
No, it's not a question of responsible. I mean, it is a good question. I do think that when you start to rely on these ideas of like kind of you know, like isolated, lonely person, that sometimes you do rely on some, you know, preconceptions about those communities, right? That they must be inherently isolating and lonely. And I don't think that what little we know about this man's life, I don't know if that's true. Now, of course, the news stories say he was a loner, right? Which is, you know, the standard. Maybe there's like been 2 shooters in the past 2 years who are not described that way. But I read that and I was like, okay, he's a loner. And yet in the same article, it says he went to this dance hall and then the other one in Alhambra up the street every single night. You know, like, this is a man that went out dancing every night at the age of 72. Like, it's the type of social life that one would hope for their parents almost, you know? I would be thrilled if my parents said that they're going ballroom dancing every night and meeting with people. And this was basically his life. This was the center of his life, were these two dance halls.
We'll have more with J. Caspian Kang in a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Jay, like a lot of what you do in your columns at The New Yorker, I kind of compare it to media criticism. And going back a little bit to what you were talking about earlier about the way the narrative shifted and the way it's almost like a different value system around these narratives or something shifted. What have you noticed about the way the media has covered the Monterey Park shooting and how it kind of shifted as more became known?
Well, I think there's two things that I noticed. The first was, you know, like you, many years ago, I also covered mass shootings. And one of the stories I wrote, I think like 11 years ago or something like that, which was about a mass shooting at a nursing school in Oakland, right by the airport. And this was a Korean-American guy who killed, I think, 7 or 8 fellow classmates over like a dispute over like a tuition refund or something like that. Just totally as senseless as you can get. And my angle for that piece, which, you know, is a magazine piece, so I spent a long time on it, was like, why does nobody care about this? And there was this thing being like, why do I care about it? You know, like, why does it feel personal to me? And some of the talk was about Virginia Tech, where the shooter was also Korean American. And, I think that the general claim that this was like swept under the rug at that point and didn't really count was correct, because the victims were immigrants who had very precarious lives. They were going to what was a predatory nursing school to get these degrees, you know, like they had sort of been suckered into this, and that like this is all just like sort of immigrants right on the edge of poverty, or sometimes in poverty. So like people just didn't care as much, right? I think that this by extension, and perhaps this is some of the work of the last 3 years or whatever, you know, I do think that there was quite a bit of coverage of this. This was taken very seriously. So I think there was that change. And then I think the second change is like what we were discussing before, which was that all of this gets filtered through this larger narrative, right? And yesterday I was talking to my friend about this, about how like there really is now an infrastructure around this sort of stop AAPI hate, right? Even the term AAPI, which I just have never used in my life and never heard before the last 3 years, you know, I knew it existed, but it was like, it's almost like a curiosity, like what's AAPI? There's sort of this proliferation of this infrastructure around this idea of AAPI hate. You know, it has 501c organizations now, celebrities talk about it, right? Like, there's like Instagram posts, there's money that goes into it. There's all sorts of like foundations within Hollywood or whatever that are just like, let's like boost Asian American creators to stop AAPI hate, all this sort of stuff, right? Even with in our journalism industry, there are initiatives to try and get, you know, like let's get more Chinese language speaking reporters, for example, so that we can cover these stories properly. Like all that is very important. But yeah, I think that because this infrastructure exists, right, that is all sort of loosely tied around this one idea, that everything by necessity then runs through that idea and through that infrastructure. And so then when it doesn't appear to be relevant, then we just bail on it, you know, and then it becomes like something else. And I would say that like One of the things that I would hope would happen, and I think is happening to a certain extent, because I do think the LA Times is quite good about this. You know, like they do have like reporters who have spent quite a long time in the San Gabriel Valley where Monterey Park is located. Like, you know, my friend Frank Xiong, for example, is somebody who does this. That the stories could sort of live outside of just like the difference of these people, and that it wouldn't just be seen as like an interracial conflict, right? Like that. And yet I think nationally it's still going to be sort of thought of that way, but I think like locally it's getting a little bit better. I don't know. How about you? Like, how do you think that this sort of fits in within the larger context of like stop AAPI hate hashtags and the larger sort of infrastructure of around Asian hate crimes?
I've been thinking about this a lot. It's been interesting because I've actually seen a fair bit of vitriol on social media, including in my own Twitter feed directed at me, at people who, you know, were drawing attention to the history that a lot of people don't know. And, you know, some of these kind of larger issues about what Monterey Park stood for and stands for and that kind of thing. And people are saying, like, stop race baiting. You know, and I, as I mentioned before, I was thinking about the strands of history. That's where my head is. You know, the reason that the language around Chinese immigrants back in the 19th century, even for people who supported them, like actually there were, for example, a lot of Christian missionaries on the West Coast who were trying to, you know, evangelize the Chinese, and they were kind of publicly supporting the Chinese. The way they talk about the Chinese is like that they're this kind of heathen sort of alien sort of class that can't assimilate. It is the perpetual foreigner thing. Yeah. And, you know, when I think about what was it that caused Chinese Exclusion Act, is it economics? Was it race? Was it religion? The reality is it's all of those things. And that's what I think is particular about the Asian American experience and the way it kind of brings all those things out. So, you know, the way I ended my piece was so like basically we were scrambling the jets, and then we thought that this might be this thing, and then it turned out to be just another mass shooting, again, as terrible as that may be. And I went back to working on my book and this history. And the point of the piece was like, hey, there's a reason that people felt this way, and it relates to this history and the commonalities in that experience that we experience today.
Well, I think, like, you know, taking the most charitable possible thinking for why people might be mad about this type of response, or why they might be saying, stop making it about race, right? This is the most charitable possible. So I'm not saying any of these people think this. I assume the vast majority of them are just mad that somebody's talking about race at all. But there is an argument I think that can be made, and it's one that's occurred to me, that what we have right now is a group of people who are incentivized to make things about race, and that they have, like we said, sort of pre-written responses if this is like about race in any way, whatever that means, right? When we do that, right, when that is the rote response, there is a minimizing effect to the instances where it is not, right? And that there is a level of tragedy that we have implicitly argued that it is higher if the shooter is white than if the shooter is Chinese in this instance, right? And I struggle with this myself. The main difference is that if this was a white shooter, like basically I was thinking about this today, it was basically like, okay, if this is a Chinese shooter, it lasts in the news cycle for 2 days, right? If this is a white shooter, it lasts for 4 days. That's functionally the difference, you know? And that like, it does kind of mean that one tragedy is seen as more of a tragedy. And like, that's a very uncomfortable thought to have. And like, I find myself going back and forth because on the one point I want to reject it, but the second time I have a very hard time arguing that it's not true. Of course it's true. You know, of course it's true that like if the shooter was white, that there would be more attention, that people would be more outraged, you know, that there would be much more coverage of this. And I'm not sure if it should matter in that sort of way. And I think that it, you know, some people, maybe 2% of the people who are yelling on you at Twitter, maybe they're thinking that. I don't know. How would you respond to them?
Well, I mean, I think what you're saying is smart and responsible. Like, we don't want that kind of larger kind of narrative, you know, like this one very good sort of impulse, which is to kind of highlight the experience of, which doesn't get talked about enough, of Asian Americans experiencing racism and bigotry and violence and that kind of thing. We don't want that to obscure other really important, just as important issues. I guess like one other sort of forward-looking question is like this thing that we touched on about the relentlessness of mass shootings and why this issue is so frozen in the pervasiveness of guns in America. Do you have thoughts about how to unfreeze that discussion?
No, but I generally am pretty agnostic about it. You know, I know that from a personal standpoint, like as a father, I do worry about my kid's safety, I think, like everybody else. I have the same nightmares as everyone. But I find it difficult to really think of my own job as being an advocacy to sort of go out and increase gun control in the United States. But at the same time, you know, I think that it feels like a museum these days when these things happen, right? That it feels almost like the moment is instantly registered to the past. And the reason why it is because people don't actually have the demands of the present in which they feel like they can respond to it or change it, right? Like that's sort of the present moment where you feel like, okay, well, maybe we can do things to make it not happen. And I do think that a large portion of the public has given up on that in terms of any type of significant federal gun control. Anything that would be enough to satisfy the idea that perhaps this isn't going to happen again, right? Like that would, I think, require something like an Australian gun buyback. And that those types of ideas, right? I don't think people have belief in that anymore. You know, I think people have sort of settled into the idea that this is going to be a violent country with a lot of guns and a lot of homicide. And they're going to look at the charts of what happens in Japan. They're going to look at the charts of what happens in England and other countries, Australia. And they're going to just think, well, we're just not going to get there, but we should, right? And that the sort of political layout to get from point A to point B, I don't think anyone knows that. I don't know. What do you think?
I feel a similar kind of futility as you, because the ultimate root of the issue is the sheer number of guns in America. It's like an absurd per capita number of guns that we have is like similar to Yemen. Right. But on the other hand, I talked to a lot of folks in the gun control advocacy world, and it's important to guard against that futility. And I guess I think a little bit about incremental but important changes. And I think actually red flag laws is a good example. This is something I've written about. And these are laws that a lot of states have actually passed at this point. This allows, like, if you're worried about somebody, you know, family member or friend or whatever, or who you think might be dangerous, it puts into place a procedure that somebody's guns can be temporarily taken from them. And there's a legal process, a due process, where this person can contest that. And California has one of these laws. The key thing, I think, on these laws is they're only as good as awareness about them and the implementation of them. And my impression on red flag laws is we have a ways to go for people to know that these are possibilities and that they're tools that can be used. And, you know, in Monterey Park, if people were worried about him and knew he had a gun, there is a procedure that they could contact law enforcement and get that gun taken. So, you know, I think it is important for us to stay optimistic and not sort of be numb to all of this. Jay, this was, you know, can't thank you enough for taking time to talk about this. It's important. It's tragic. Yeah, just really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Jay Caspian Kang is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Loneliest Americans. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Michael Luo. The show is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Sydney Cobb. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thanks so much for listening.